And in the spirit of pantomime season, by way of a bit of audience participation, you probably find on your tables some pairs of these funny-looking glasses. So when you get a minute, just put the glasses on and take a look at any of the lights in here. The reason for that will become apparent very shortly. So we're delighted tonight to have Professor Tony North with us. I thought that we'd begin just by thinking about what's meant by molecular biology. So we've got two definitions up here, one by our very own William Asprey, who was here at Leeds, who said that molecular biology is, it's about the forms, the shapes of biological molecules, it's three-dimensional. Slightly more poetic one by Max Perutz, who's going to crop up later, who said it explains to us why blood is red, grass is green, how muscles contract, sunlight makes plants grow, how living organisms have been able to evolve into ever more complex forms. I think if he was writing that now, he might have added, it also helps us understand how that now infamous spike glycoprotein on the surface of SARS-2, SARS-2-CoV, helps the virus bind to human cells and get into them. So, to start the conversation going, Tony, what would, if somebody said to you, what is molecular biology, what would your answer be?
Well, the understanding of how systems work, how living systems work in terms of the interactions between the various molecules and how molecules do interact together as a consequence of their particular shapes and properties.
I think you can't top that. I think as well, so would it be fair to say, do you think, that that type of molecular biology, that molecular biology that's based around structure, would probably never have got off the ground had it not been for a really important technique that was developed right here in Leeds back in 1913 by these two chaps here. So would you like to tell us who we've got here?
Well, on the left we have William Bragg, who by the time we were talking about was the professor of physics here in Leeds. His son, William Henry Bragg, on the right there. The son is called William Lawrence, sorry. The father is William Henry. But he was always known as Willie, in fact, in the heart, when he was young. But when he was given a knighthood, he couldn't take the title of Sir William Bragg because his father had already got that, so he took it his second name, Lawrence. Anyway, the two of them got together, and one famous occasion, which Chris will know about, is that they were on holiday in a friend's house near Scarborough when they got information from Germany about an experiment that had been carried out by X-rays passing through a crystal. And that gave a sort of pattern, but they had no idea how the pattern was generated. And it's that the two of them put together, particularly actually Lawrence, who, walking along to Cambridge, beside the river there, had a brainwave that it was something to do with the ordering of the atoms in the crystals that were looked at.
So, while we're on the subject of patterns, if you were wondering about the funny glasses, if you haven't had a chance to put them on yet, get them on now, because this is where we need the funny glasses, because this effect that Tony's talking about there, it's called diffraction. It's exhibited by all types of wave motion. So if you put the glasses on, spoiler alert, you will see, hopefully, a lovely rainbow effect. And the reason that's happening is because the visible light waves that are coming from the light source, when they pass through the minute slits that are in the lenses, they get scattered in different directions. It's an effect called diffraction, as I say, happens to all wave motions. And what the German physicist Max von Laue had found was that X-rays exhibit that same diffraction effect when they pass through crystals, because what's special about a crystal is the atoms and molecules are arranged in rows and columns, regular repeating patterns, and this causes the diffraction of the X-rays. The diffracted X-rays make a very specific pattern on a photographic film. We've got an example there. And as Tony said, the Braggs realised, Lawrence Bragg realised that with the application of some maths, you can work backwards from that pattern of spots to deduce the arrangement in space of the atoms and molecules in the crystal. But we should say at this time, Tony, shouldn't we, that the Braggs used this method to work out the structure of very simple repeating substances such as sodium chloride, ice, diamond. The challenge was, could it tell us anything about the more complex substances in biology? And this is where the role of physicists like yourself came into biology. So you're a physicist by training, aren't you? The movement of physicists into biology, you're in good company. It's a path that's been quite well trodden, hasn't it? So we're thinking names like Maurice Wilkins, Francis Crick, Gunter Stent, to name but a few. These were all physicists who moved into biology, and a lot of them, when you read about what got them into biology, a lot of them cite this little book here, What is Life? It was written by physicist Erwin Schrödinger, who's usually more famous for his role in founding quantum mechanics, for the name of the famous eponymous cat that's neither dead nor alive, and that's also provided more than several plot materials for the science sitcom Big Bang Theory, if you know it. So that would get me thinking, what was it that brought you from physics into biology, Tony?
Well, I suppose you could almost say it was an accident. I did my physics degree at King's College in London, and the head of the department there, Randall, decided that he was interested in looking at biological systems. So we actually got a grant from the Medical Research Council to set up a laboratory to look particularly at biological problems. But as we said, he was actually basically a physicist originally. Anyway, when I graduated, the opportunity arose to take up a research studentship working with Randall. And what he suggested I should work on was the structure of collagen. Now, collagen is actually, I think, the most abundant protein in the body. It's the material that makes up tendons. We've got it throughout our skins and so on. Asprey here in Leeds had already made some studies of it, but the idea was to try and look at X-ray diffraction patterns given by thin fibres, and the example I used was tendons from rat tails, which are just the right sort of thickness to be able to show their X-ray beam on, and look at the pattern that was produced there and try and deduce what were the actual arrangements in the molecules that gave rise to those patterns. I improved the patterns, but I'm afraid I did not solve the structure. That was eventually done by somebody in India using much poorer diffraction patterns than I'd got, which was a bit of a shame, but never mind.
And I'm guessing you must have been there. So I'm thinking, I've got the timing of this right, you would have been in Randall's lab when Rosalind Franklin, Raymond Gosling and Maurice Wilkins were there working on the...
That's right, yes. They were all working on the structure of nucleic acid, which, of course, an entirely different sort of substance. It's not a protein, a different sort of molecule. Again, they had managed to find a source of nucleic acids that could be used to make fibres again and to shine the X-ray beams on the fibres, look at the pattern, and from the positions of the spots given on the films that they took, they deduced various distances between atoms. What they didn't do themselves at the time, and it turned out to be really Francis Crick, who was one of those who developed some of the theory of the kind of patterns you get from long molecules that are formed into helices. They have certain characteristics that ought to come out of the diffraction pattern. But anyway, there was a bit of rivalry between what was going on in Cambridge and what was going on at King's College. And Bragg, Lawrence Bragg at the time, was head of the departments in Cambridge that were involved, and he already had a grant from the Medical Research Council, and he said that they couldn't have two different MRC-supported groups working on the same problem. So he told Crick and Watson to stop thinking about nucleic acid and get on with what they were supposed to be doing. Well, they couldn't refrain too long before having further thoughts. So,
John Turton Randall might have missed out on DNA, but did you not say that he left a legacy that...
He did.
A legacy that all of us will be familiar with.
That's
just
right.
Just like going into the kitchen.
Randall worked during the war on the structure of... On the design of devices to recognise submarines, to detect the positions of submarines. What they called was ASDIC, and the foundation of the actual system that could be used in ASDIC is the cavity magnetron, and that is an electronic device which is present in powering microwave ovens in all of your kitchens. So Randall's, funnily enough, left the man he didn't have a reputation, because nobody ever thinks of Randall when they look at their microwave, whereas Randall would have preferred that they were thought of him when he looking at something interesting in biology. But anyway,
rest assured, every time I warm up my soup in the microwave now, I will stop and pause and think of John Turton Randall. Believe
me. Yes, that's right.
So you then moved, didn't you, from being with Randall's group, King's College, to the Royal Institution to work with Lawrence Bragg?
That's right. Well, it so happened that the former director and the head of the Royal Institution in London had retired. Lawrence Bragg was still in Cambridge, but he was very concerned about what had been actually rather lapsing at the Royal Institution. And Lawrence Bragg was very interested in trying to reinvigorate the Royal Institution, which is where Henry Bragg had been head for a long time. Now, you may well be aware of some of the activities in the Royal Institution, because the Christmas lectures are very well known. Well, they were originally established by Michael Faraday and Humphrey Davy, and they'd lasted ever since. And Bragg was very keen that they should be revived properly, but also that there should be some research going on in the laboratories in the RI. And the way that he thought that that might be started was by establishing a collaboration between his newly set up group at the RI and the MRC group in Cambridge, where people had been working, and in particular Max Perutz had been working on... Max Perutz had been working on the structure of hemoglobin, and John Kendrew, the one on the left, had been working on the structure of myoglobin. And those two proteins, Bragg decided that there should be collaboration with some of the people at the RI working on one helping out Perutz and others helping out Kendrew.
So that this might be a good time to just try and convey some sense of the size of the challenge you were up against there. Because I said earlier that when William and Lawrence Bragg developed X-ray crystallography, they were using it to solve the structure of simple repeating things like ice and diamond and sodium chloride. Now all of a sudden proteins present a much bigger challenge. So Proteins, right, so I realise there are probably going to be some protein scientists and X-ray crystallographers in the audience, but for the non-scientists, just a little crash course in biochemistry. 2016, scientists at European Space Agency got very excited because a probe discovered on a comet, Rosetta, traces of this stuff, it's amino acids, glycine. The reason everybody got excited was that amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. And proteins are not just an essential dietary requirement of the sort we're going to tuck into in about an hour's time. I like to think of them as nature's nanomachines. They're the workhorses of living things. And Tony mentioned William Asprey at Leeds, who was up there on the top left earlier. For about the first half of the 20th century, there was a recognition that proteins are absolutely essential to living processes, but nobody really understood the chemical nature of proteins. They knew they were made of these little amino acids, but it was known, proteins were known to be huge, whereas amino acids were known to be small. So the conundrum is, how do these small things make molecules that are so big? And it was actually through textile research of the kind that Asprey was doing, applying the Bragg's method to the keratin fibres in wool, that showed that the keratin proteins are long chains of amino acids joined together, a bit like beads on a string, prompted one of Asprey's colleagues to come up with this witty limerick: amino acids in chains are the cause, or so the X-ray explains, of the stretching of wool and its strength when you pull, and show why it shrinks when it rains. And how they must have laughed when he came up with that. Of course, Asprey's work showed that proteins are long chains of amino acids, and then just almost literally up the road, I had Archer Martin and Richard Singh, working at the Wool Industries Research Association, got the 1952 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for their development of a method of partition chromatography, which allowed Fred Sanger there to work out the actual order of amino acids in a protein chain, that first protein being insulin, and you can see the page there from Sanger's notebook. Should say the plaque there was unveiled by Leeds Phil and Lip in 2019. But it's all well and good knowing that proteins are long chains of these amino acids. The proteins Asprey looked at were fibrous. They were kind of easier, but the type of protein structure that Tony's talking about there, that Perux and Kendra are working on, hemoglobin, they're not fibrous, are they, Tony?
Yes.
That's the...
That is the transition, really, between fibrous proteins, as we've got in hair and wool and so on, and in collagen, in which the chain is all stretched out. The difference is that the sorts of proteins that are in enzymes and things like hemoglobin, the chain is wrapped up in a very complex sort of arrangement to make a sort of globule.
Piece of molecular origami, if you like. Yeah.
And that was the next stage to be done. And there was, I suppose, some collaboration between what was going on in America, some people tried to work out that. And then in Bragg's group in Cambridge, there were already structures going on insulin as one, but also myoglobin and hemoglobin. And those were two important ones to press on with. And for those who don't know, hemoglobin is a structure in which each molecule is made of four little subunits, and one of those subunits is very similar to the structure of myoglobin. Now, myoglobin is the protein that will store oxygen in the blood. Hemoglobin is the protein that carries oxygen around from the lungs to the tissues.
We should say as well, I mean, is it right to say there was a fair degree of scepticism amongst some in the protein science community about whether this could actually be done, whether you could actually use... I think they were thinking, X-ray crystallography, yeah, sure, you'll get the structure of sodium chloride, but a protein, really? You know, because what hemoglobin gave, what, 7,000 reflections, is it? So we're talking, what, 7,000 spots on one of those X-ray films? So, I mean, as far as I can see, you have two huge challenges there. One is the sheer number of calculations you had to do. Secondly, there's this problem called the phase problem, isn't there? So don't worry, for non-scientists, we're not going to get too technical, but in a nutshell, to make any sense of those spots on the X-ray film, you need to know two key things. You need to know the intensity of the spots. You also need to know the phase of the wave that made it. So if you think about a wave motion, it's got peaks, it's got troughs. You need to know whether, not only how intense that spot is, but whether the spot was made by a peak, a wave, or its peak or its trough. What was the phase? And that was a real problem, wasn't it, trying to solve that? And that's yes. What Perutz cracked.
The essence of the solution is to make derivatives of the protein which are identical, except that they have additional atoms put in, one, say, in each of the subunits, and these heavy atom derivatives gave X-ray patterns that were subtly different as a result of the additional atoms. And when you've got two or more different varieties of these changes, you can then start coming back and working out the phases of the X-ray reflections. So,
well, apparently that was such an achievement as well, that apparently Bragg was moved to tears of emotion when that was cracked, because that just opened up the whole field. And so you, at this time, Max Perutz was preparing his crystals of hemoglobin in Cambridge, and then they were being sent to you at the RI to do the X-ray work, yeah?
Well, yes, the sort of work that had to be done on any of this structure was, first of all, to prepare the protein, then to make these derivatives with added atoms, then to somehow to crystallise them, put the crystals in front of X-ray beams, and measure the intensities of all of the spots given by the X-ray beam. Initially, all this was done on photographic films. Later on, we had devices called diffractometers where you could move the detector around to make the measurements. So you need to essentially to have about four different groups of people, one of them making the protein, one making the derivatives, one crystallizing, one trying to work out the mathematics from the information of the crystals in order to get a pattern. And from the pattern and the dimensions that showed up, to try and see how the chain of protein could be folded up in such a way that it gave the pattern.
We should say that, so you mentioned the formidable mathematics involved. It strikes me as being a really exciting time, because this is the time when it's becoming apparent that computing is going to be a major help in this. Was it not John Kendrew who was working on? Did he not use the EDSAC?
He used one of the first computers in the country, and we at the Royal Institution also acquired our own computer in the end to do this.
It sounded like quite a horrific device. What I read about it, valves forever burning out, and like pipes with mercury flowing along them, and all that for one kilobyte of memory, which. I mean, made the old ZX81 look formidable, if anyone remembers that. Although I must say, actually, from what I read as well, at times you resorted to less cutting-edge technology to deal with some of these challenges, because you were taking the X-ray pictures of hemoglobin for Perutz, but you also chipped in on Kendrew's myoglobin work with a rather unusual trip to Hamleys. Is that not right? I believe in your obituary, you wrote to David Phillips, you went and cleaned Hamleys out of all their Meccano sets for the purpose of some kind of model building. We were just looking at the obituary.
I don't think there was any connection between cameras and model components. That was where we were.
It was something to do with building something to help with working out the electron density in myoglobin. Yeah. You said in your obituary to Phillips that you were deputed with the task of going to Hamleys and coming back laden with Meccano sets for the purpose of it. So, you know, you had a...
Well, I'm not quite sure how all that worked out. But anyway, as far as hemoglobin was concerned, I did collaborate with Perutz because we had a more powerful X-ray generator in at the Royal Institution than they had in Cambridge. So I was able to make more accurate measurements of some of the X-ray pattern. I would get crystals from Perutz. He had mounted them all in little glass tubes ready to put onto my equipment. And one of his assistants would come up from Cambridge to London, hand over the crystals to me, and I would make measurements on these various crystals and then send them back to Cambridge, where they did the necessary calculations. It was a rather different situation, though, with myoglobin, because most of the X-ray measurements were actually made in at the Royal Institution for that, none of them in Cambridge. Slight differences in the way we divided up the work.
It all paid off, because 1960, what Bragg referred to as Everest being climbed. I like to think of it as a molecular Everest. So you had here structure of hemoglobin at 5.5 angstrom resolution. So again, an angstrom is a tenth of a nanometer. To give you some perspective on that, I think there are human hair is anywhere between 80 to 100,000 nanometers in diameter. So it gives you some idea of the scale we're talking about here, right? And there's the paper with Max Perutz and your name on it. Apparently Max Perutz was so delighted with some of the X-ray photographs of haemoglobin, he was putting them in his Christmas cards that he was sending. So I'd like to think that some of those were the ones you'd taken, Tony, that you popped into Max Perutz's Christmas cards. Yeah, I mean, I read that, like I said, the progress of this work may be likened to the scaling of Mount Everest. A series of camps were established at ever-increasing heights till finally a last camp was set up from which the successful assault on the summit was made. And so this is a landmark in molecular biology, because this, as your late colleague David Phillips said, the scoffers, like all those protein scientists, all the naysayers about whether you could ever actually use X-ray crystallography to solve a protein structure, were silenced. I think that year was the tercentenary of the Royal Society, and so there was a big exhibition put on, and Bragg won a victory, a minor victory there, because somebody wanted to have a nuclear power station as the kind of flagship of the exhibition. Bragg fought that, and he got the models of haemoglobin and myoglobin on display, and he actually gave Prince Philip a personal tour of them. I think the very young late Queen Elizabeth II, I think she came along as well, was very interested in them, and prompted one of her ladies in waiting to ask Bragg, "I never knew we had all these funny little coloured balls inside us." But for all that, Bragg, he was, how's the word, obviously he was delighted at those two structures being solved, but he did warn that it might well be over a decade before another protein structure was solved.
Anyway, look at haemoglobin.
Oh yeah, let's take a look at that third. Now that's important to me, because I mentioned earlier William Astbury showing that the keratin proteins in wool are these long chains of amino acids. What he found was they could do something interesting. They could change shape. They could take on an elongated form or a contracted form. And as you saw in that witty limerick that explained the stretchiness of wool. But you know, for Astbury, that formed a really powerful idea that understanding living systems is about understanding the shapes of these macromolecules and how they change shape. Haemoglobin took that to a whole new level there, didn't it? If you want to explain to us why.
One of the shapes, yeah, will take up oxygen molecules and carry it, and then it changes the other shape and the oxygen molecule is deposited. So that's how haemoglobin works, to transport oxygen from the lungs to the tissues. So that's showing you the change of shape in the haemoglobin molecule that just provides enough space from oxygen to be added to it in the one form and then thrown away. Okay.
And there, so 1962,
nice.
Solving those structures of myoglobin and haemoglobin earned Max Perutz. So Max Perutz is second one in there.
Second one along.
Yeah, and you've got John Kendrell there on the far right. And then the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, wasn't it? And you can see that they're sharing that there with James Watson.
But it also happened that they gave the Nobel Prize for that year. They were given two different prizes. One was for this structural work on myoglobin and haemoglobin. The other was for the structure of DNA, the three-dimensional structure of DNA.
But as I say there, you know, Bragg's concerned, isn't he, that, well, you know, that's great, but, you know, was it a fluke that we got these... I mean, you know, how long will it be before we get another one? And he was spectacularly proven wrong, wasn't he, by his own team, which brings us onto this stuff here, lysozyme.
Right. Well, it's just... a structure called lysozyme, and most of you probably have never heard of it, never thinks it sounds interesting at all. Have you ever wondered why your eyes don't get sore? They're exposed all the time to the elements and all the rubbish that's going around, yet somehow we don't get our eyes infected. And the reason is that we produce tears, and the tears contain this substance called lysozyme. It happened that the sort that we looked at came from headaches, but the picture there shows you one way of producing lysozyme in sufficient quantity in order to make crystals and determine the three-dimensional structure, which in the course of time we did. And there you can see a representation of the molecule. It's folded up with a groove on one side, and the groove is sufficient to bind this long chain shown in yellow there and to break it as a result of the positions of two particular amino acids, an aspartic acid one side, glutamic acid the other side, which will break the bond and break up the chain into small lengths.
Again, this is another landmark, isn't it? Because this is the first enzyme.
It was the third globular protein structure to be determined, and was the first enzyme. That's a functional protein to be determined.
So they worked by chewing up the peptidoglycan in the bacterial walls, is that right? Was it Louis Johnson, a PhD student, who synthesised the substrate?
Yes.
And here we've got the team.
Here's the team.
Do you want to take us through who we've got there?
Well, the chap on the left is Gareth Mayer, then Colin Blake. In the middle is Louise Johnson, who was actually a research student at the time that she was involved at all. Then me, then David Phillips, and Rajag Sharma on the right-hand side there. So it was a group of people, and we were sort of collaborating together on this structure. David was particularly involved in making the measurements from crystals. Colin was involved in studying the solution and making crystals. I was responsible for actually processing the data, doing on the mathematics of it. And Louise came in later looking at the various forms of the substrate that the lysozyme would act on.
So that was 1965, I think, that structure was solved.
It started in 1960,
yeah.
And we got to that point by 1965.
Which is great, because as I say, Bragg was delighted to be proven wrong in his kind of Jeremiah predictions about, you know, it taking decades before another structure would be solved within 5 years. There's another structure solved by his own team.
Before any American competitors could solve it.
And solved in time for Bragg's 75th birthday as well, and the 50th anniversary of his Nobel Prize that he got with his father in 1950, because they were the only father and son team to have ever won a Nobel Prize, weren't they? So it all, you know, the stars were all in alignment on that one. I think Bragg said something like the most recent he described it as the most recent experience, which to me has been the greatest of all.
Right.
But following year, 1966 was a landmark year as well, because did you not predict the structure of another protein, lactalbumin, on the basis of its similarities, homology with lysozyme?
Right, yes.
Now again, I would say that's another key moment.
Yes, I suppose it is really the first time that the structure and activity of a protein could be worked out by comparison from another one.
Yeah.
Not computerized intelligence, CI.
Yeah.
Natural intelligence.
Natural, yeah. So, you know, 1966, a landmark year, and apparently England won the World Cup as well. But, you know, you say not computerized intelligence, but then, you know, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry last year went to the three guys who did the AlphaFold AI program. And, you know, you don't wonder whether the kind of evolutionary origins of all that have their roots somewhere back there when you were doing that prediction of lactalbumin from the lysozyme structure. When you left the RI, so then you went to Oxford, right?
That's right. Bragg retired, and it was arranged with support from the Medical Research Council that a number of us, David, myself, would move to Oxford, where there was already, of course, active work on crystals going on with Dorothy Hodgkin, who in the end managed to solve the three-dimensional structure of insulin. So that was...
Again, that took some doing, didn't it? Because she did,
yes.
If I remember rightly, she started on insulin in about 1934.
Yes, it took a long time.
Early 70s, I think, it was finally solved. I always remember that she's got that recollection when she got her first crystal patterns from it, and she said she was in such a state of euphoria that she just went roaming the streets of Oxford at about 3 a.m, attracting the concerns of some police officer about what this young lady was doing, just wandering around Oxford in a daze. And, you know, would have been interesting to hear her explain, you don't understand, officer, I've just got my first insulin crystal diffraction patterns. It is interesting to note, structural biology seems to be a field where it's really quite distinguished by female scientists who've made a real name for themselves. And I mean, I guess the two names you'd spring to mind, Dorothy Hodgkin, Rosalind Franklin, but you know, there's a lot more, isn't there? Kathleen Lonsdale, Barbara Lowe, June Broomhead, Pauline Cowan, and
I think it might be worth pointing out that actually both of the Braggs were very interested always in ensuring that women were given appropriate positions and merit.
Mm. Mm.
So anyway,
did you say that much as she was a fantastic crystallographer, she wasn't much of a driver?
Well, David Phillips and I sort of visited her one or two occasions before we actually moved there and had a meal with them, and then we were driven back to the railway station, sometimes by Dorothy, who didn't really seem to... She knew that this stick thing had to be moved to change gear or something, but wasn't very au fait with how to drive the car. Other occasions, we were driven by her husband, who happily drove along, talking to the people in the back of the car all the time. So it was quite an experience. All right. Better move on.
Yeah, so as I say, you know, I've just mentioned the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2024 for AlphaFold. But yeah, I do like to think that traces its roots to some of what we're talking about tonight. After Oxford, you came to Leeds to head up the Asprey Centre for Structural Biology, which is interesting because John Kendrew reckons it's in Leeds where the first experiment in molecular biology was carried out with Asprey's work on the keratin proteins in hair. We've talked about you know, how he found that they ever changed. I guess, you know, Asprey was dead before you came here, but you must have crossed paths with him earlier on.
Yes,
in your career, yeah?
Yeah, I've met Asprey, that's right. But one of the things that he did take, I better not go too much in the length of it, But after Mozart had died, a member of the Novello family, Vincent Novello, went to visit her because they'd got some money to help support Mozart's widow. And while he was visiting her, he sort of said, well, could he have a lock of hair? And she was sort of very reluctant about that. And he went off, but then he returned later on and says, sort of, you know, I'm sure I can't have a lock of hair. And she gave him an envelope containing this lock of hair. She also gave him another envelope containing what she said was a lock of their son's hair. And that envelope actually has written on it. Now, by a very strange circuitous route, these two locks of hair have arrived in Leeds and are held in the university library here. But when they arrived, then Astbury, of course, was rather keen, and because he'd been working on the structure of hair, so he thought he'd take an X-ray picture of Mozart's hair, and that's what you see over on the right there. Now, there's still a bit of a question. Had she given him really a piece of Mozart hair, or was it some other? Perhaps it was another example of the son's hair. That we don't know.
I mean, I always love that story because, alongside molecular biology, Astbury's great passion was classical music, and he was always reaching for these musical metaphors, like saying, you know, the fibrous proteins he worked on were nature's chosen instrument in the symphony of creation. It's lovely to think there was a time when scientists got poetic. So I just think that's a wonderful convergence of his two passions, molecular biology and classical music. I mean, you know, the amount of scientific information that we can derive from an X-ray diffraction photograph in the keratin in Mozart's hair is limited. But it's still a great story. And also while at Leeds,
well,
you were pioneering.
Well, this is to do with further developments. When I was still in Oxford, we were starting to try to compare the structures together, and we actually were setting up databases. Well, this is quite an interesting thing because from the very start of crystallography, people have been depositing their results in a database which was set up originally in Cambridge so that it's available to anybody to look at. And when we got our first protein structures, we also insisted that they were deposited there for anybody to get hold of if they want to. So I think openness in this sense has been rather an important factor in the way that we've progressed in certain areas of science. Anyway, my interest was in comparing different protein structures and being able to look at them in detail. And one of the developments that we made when we came to Leeds here was to set up a computer graphic system which is capable of showing stereoscopic images. Now, like we were sort of looking at with his funny glasses, if you have stereo views and your left eye sees one picture and the right eye sees a slightly different slant, you can get a three-dimensional picture of what's going on. And that's what we were developing with a computer graphic system here in Leeds. We did get them made commercially, and several were sold in different places. So that's one of the sort of moves ahead that we made. But then, I don't know what we've got left. Oh yes, well, we can leave it at that and show this rather interesting thing of a family tree that was set up. The way that...
Let's get that tree back.
That the Braggs to William Henry, the elder one, did have Astbury as a student of his. William Lawrence, at one point in Cambridge, had Randall, who then had Wilkins working under him, and then under Bragg we've got Perutz, Kendrews, Crick and Watson, all having got involvement in Nobel Prizes. So they're shown in yellow. Okay.
Just looking at that, it's just struck me now that one person we've not mentioned here, who was a big name in crystallography, was J.D. Bernal. Did you ever rub shoulders with him?
Oh, J.D. Bernal was the sage.
The sage. Yeah.
He knew everything about anything.
He was involved in the planning of D-Day, wasn't he?
He didn't actually do anything very novel as far.
Yeah, I mean, I read a biography of him, and he's not only doing... He started off with... Dorothy Hodgkin started working with him, didn't she? They were doing the pepsin structure. But then he's writing books, and he's getting involved in the planning of D-Day. How's he done that?
He was a polymath.
Endangered species. So that, I like this. This gives you, for me, this gives me some idea, really, of the importance of structural biology. Like that list of UK Nobel Prize winners, that's just worth reflecting on for a minute, that shows the importance of the field.
Well, one particular aspect of it is that a very large number of them had worked in Cambridge at the laboratory that Lawrence Bragg had set up. It isn't actually quite up to date. There's some more recent ones since then. David Blow, for instance. But anyway,
We opened with quotations, didn't we? I think this is a really good one too. As we wind down, this is a good one to finish with. John Locke, you know, a few centuries before structural biology and X-ray diffraction. What do you like about that quotation, Tony?
It's really completely true. It has emerged that somehow or other, we do know the mechanical affections of these particles now. So it was an interesting thought that 1600 and something, he could think it might be possible. Right. Well, now, that this sort of starts moving me into another area, because having been involved in structural biology, I was... one of the founder members of the British Biophysical Society, but there had been an international union for pure and applied biophysics set up a number of years earlier, and the first time that they met in the United Kingdom was 1984, a celebrated date for other reasons, but it's one that's in my memory, because at that stage I was asked to act as treasurer of this international congress that took place in Bristol in 1984. I'm glad to say that we had an even balance at the end of the financial arrangements, apart from the lack of a payment from one attendant. I think he was French, who deposited without having given his conference fee. Anyway, it started me with an interest in involvement with the International Union for Pure and Applied Biophysics, and that really enlarged my involvement with activities going in other countries, and that's one of the really important aspects of science, really, collaboration. Not just collaboration with the immediate local people, but in what's happening on a worldwide front. Anyway, I stayed in...
We can see a few of the places those collaborations have taken you to.
The one before, though, while we're just having a look at it, I took here because I had become a member of the council of the International Union, and... then I became Secretary General of it, and the Secretary General is involved in making meetings from time to time, and in between congresses we would have local meetings, which sometimes would take place in the home country of the Secretary General. So one of these occasions it was due to take place in England, so I said, well, right, we'll have it in Leeds. So there you are, in the good old-fashioned days when Leeds University owned this place, Rosehurst, and used it for conference for people to attend. We had our little meeting here.
Just remind me, what's special about Rosehurst?
Sorry?
Remind people, what's special about Rosehurst?
Oh, it's the Braggs.
It's where they live, isn't it?
It has been the Braggs house, yes, that's originally
a plaque. Yeah, it has a plaque, doesn't it? Yeah.
So there's me in the middle there in the white jacket, Jean Garnier, who's one of the French representatives. With the next one over there is David Parry from New Zealand and his wife beside them. And then there's Jean Garnier's wife, and on the right hand end is Gerville Gauvier, who was one of the Indian reps. So shows a bit of an international thing, but it really shows the involvement of Leeds. I was keen on having that. So
definitely. And then from Leeds,
it led me on to go to various places. As Secretary General, I was involved with the financial arrangements. And when the Union had a Congress, it would give a certain sum of money to the support of students and the costs of speakers going there. So I'd arranged that sum of £5,000, I think it was, or some perhaps it's got dollars, I've forgotten what, should go to Delhi to support things. So we duly arrived in Delhi. Oh, yes, the money had come, but it was in the bank, and the bank is somewhere a distance away, and they don't like to carry it to the Congress Centre. So I couldn't get hold of the money to pay the students and the fees of attendance. But fortunately, some extra money did come in, because people who hadn't paid in advance then paid their membership fee when they arrived. And my dear wife was given the responsibility of sitting in my office and handing out money as appropriate. So that was Delhi, but we did enjoy one visit to Delhi. The next place, oh no, that's rather skipped matters.
Oh, right, okay. Shall I go back to Delhi?
Well, it's almost skipped matters. Next place I went to was Buenos Aires, where they had the Congress there. We duly arranged, it was a very nice, competent fellow making all of the Congress arrangements there, and we again arranged that a sum of money should be transferred, and that was very easy because the Argentinians were using the American currency as well. They were all jointly doing that, so it's all going to be easy. We arrived in Buenos Aires and were met by a rather long-faced chap there who said, "I'm terribly sorry, our Argentinian financial system has crashed. All of the banks have closed. Nothing is open, so you won't be able to get hold of your money." So again, my wife was put to good use in doling out money. The meeting after that, I had ceased to be Secretary General, I did go to one of the planning meetings for it. It was to be in France, and I was very glad about the general arrangements that they were talking about. But the small group of us who'd gone in advance, a year in advance, to arrange the final details, which included the chap Gurdjieff Gauvier, who I'd shown you in the Rosehurst site. We went to a very nice little restaurant to have a meal together, and we were selecting what we were going to eat, and Gurdjieff asked, "Can he please have a vegetarian dish?" And they looked absolutely aghast. "What's that?" The chef of this nice little French restaurant didn't have a clue about providing a vegetarian dish. In the end, all he could do was provide the same as we had, but without the meat. So it gave me an opportunity to say to the organiser, "Look, you've got to get this right next year, because you're going to have quite a lot of vegetarians turning up and wanting to eat." So that was the end of my involvement there. A couple more things. Well, I had a meeting afterwards in Rio de Janeiro, in fact. On the course of it, we went through Machu Picchu and then stayed up in Rio de Janeiro. So you could say that's the highlight of my career was on high there, having got to a satisfactory conference. So
I think that's a great note for us to finish on. I've just got one last question and a point regarding highlights of your career. Firstly, I was wondering, there might be a few young scientists, PhD student, postdocs here tonight. What would your advice be to a young scientist starting out now? Any tips?
It's difficult to say how to advise somebody, I must say. I mean, it remains an extremely interesting field that I was in. And it's developed in different sorts of ways, become much more widespread, but still, almost every day nowadays, you're reading in the paper about some new developments that have been prepared, a novel compound which will bind in some way to one of the bacteria or viruses that are affecting us. So it's a subject that is still wide open to all sorts of applications, many of which are going to be quite helpful in deciding the future of humankind, if you like. But a very important feature, I think, of all of my work has been to do with collaboration, working with other people. And that's a most important sort of activity to have, I think.
Absolutely, that's a great take-home message. I'll just finish. You talked there about the high point of your career. I think the culture of science has changed a lot since the days of Max Perutz and Fred Sanger, you know, when they could spend the best part of 20 years working away at a problem without churning out a paper in Nature every week or bringing in £500,000 grant program grant to justify their academic existence. And I'm sure if there are researchers in the audience tonight, they'll probably identify that we live in pretty metric-obsessed times, you know, when you live or die by your publications and the grants you've brought in. We've heard a lot about Nobel Prizes tonight, but for me, the real yardstick of your scientific success is not how many papers you've published or how many £1,000,000 of grants you've brought in or even whether you've won a Nobel Prize. The real yardstick of success for me is, has your field of study been the subject of a question on University Challenge? And I can tell you now, tonight, Tony, you have that glittering accolade. 2 weeks ago, Christ College, Cambridge versus St. Edmund's College, Oxford. The question was, what was the first protein to have its 3D structure solved? The answer was buzzed back in as myoglobin, correctly. Now, you may not have taken the X-ray photographs for myoglobin like you did for haemoglobin, but you made the trip to Hanley's to buy the Meccano set. That'll do for me, and on that note, I'll thank you very much for a wonderful evening this evening. Thank you.
We'll take some questions, I think. Maybe you could share a mic and our robe, so we can sort of... A question for Tony or Kirsten. Yeah, Jenny.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I've greatly enjoyed the conversation. Thank you. If I could go back to Mozart and the images and people's interest in hair. Everybody's very fascinated by the fact you can do kind of forensics on hair and decide it was Mozart or it was his son or what have you. So my question is there any way that your technology picks up on individual differences or not? Thank you.
Yes, well, the interesting thing about hair is that it was certainly, when I sort of first thought about the possibilities, which would have been, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, it was only possible to determine the constitution of the genetic constitution of hair if you had the hair follicle, and just to have a strand off it. Apparently they weren't able to do anything about finding the genetic structure. I suspect that things have changed somewhat and that it might indeed be possible to do it, and I'd really rather intrigued if you could persuade somebody to try and look at these two samples of hair, father and son, and see if they were related.
Right, Michael has a question.
Tony, just a question. How did you actually start in all this? I mean, well, I'm interested in the boy at the school and sixth form and doing studies and so on. How does the link between that level lead on to this remarkable science and research?
Well, I don't know. You have to be interested, I think, in one of the sciences. Either physics or chemistry or something. But for that matter, biology. So you have to be used to dealing with figures and shapes of things somehow. And then I don't know, you go to a university where you get trained to some extent and also have the opportunities to find out what's going on in different areas.
And then what, do you opt into one of those? Is that
it? Sorry, what?
I said, do you then opt into something like that? Then?
You have the opportunity, if you can manage to get in the right sort of direction, where you can, say, have a research studentship or something of the sort to proceed. I think one of the unfortunate things is, in recent years with universities, is that they decided to get rid of the old technical colleges, this has reduced the possibilities of people going on day release or something of the sort into a college where they could learn something more different. But
I think it is notable that I mean, almost all of the basic findings about what we call molecular biology, I mean, you could have to do a whole session to what molecular biology is, but it's notable that all of the people at the beginning were either physicists or chemists or even mathematicians. Yeah. And actually, what we might call traditional biologists, zoologists, botanists, had very little role in founding molecular biology. I think that's quite fascinating, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Now, there's a question here.
Thank you. My name's Hazel, Tonya. As a non-scientist, first of all, could I say that was absolutely fascinating for me. So thank you. And then also, like lots of other older people, I suffer from dry eyes. So I wondered about lysozyme and the link with these little bottles of artificial tears. Is there a way of making synthetic lysozyme?
Well, yes, I should have thought so. I'm just trying to think of there was something in the paper today about. I know what it was. Yes, but it wasn't quite that. It was a sort of smearing on grease or something that would help animals that entered the cold. Like polar bears and so on, generate a sort of greasy thing that goes over their fur, and so they don't suffer from the cold in the same way. But, Yes, I don't know about tears.
Can I just come in on that? So, I mean, let's try that. I'll try that, or I can always project.
Just thinking off the top of my head, because the way that they make insulin now, you know, they used to get insulin out of recovery from cow and pig pancreas as a byproduct of the meat industry, and then in the 1970s, biotech company Genentech basically synthesised the genetic code that tells a human pancreas cell how to make the insulin protein and put that code into a bacterium, so you end up with a bacterium that's producing human insulin on an industrial scale. I'm just wondering that whether you could do it that way. What I do know is there is a goat, right? You're always a good thing. Where's he going with this? So lysozyme, as well as tears, lysozyme is also found in breast milk. And there was a company, a biotech company, that made a genetically engineered goat that has the DNA sequence to produce human lysozyme. So it's producing human lysozyme in its milk, and the idea was that that milk could be given to kids who can't breastfeed. So it's maybe not quite synthetic lysozyme, but it's a way of doing it. So, every day's a school day. There you go.
Hand back to Tony.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for your talk tonight. You took us from the kind of early origins almost of molecular biology, through to your very interested and varied life, and all sorts of interesting places that you visited. And Kirsten, thank you for being. I was going to say compere or something like that. But interrogate.
I hope I was more Michael Parkinson, not Alan Partridge.
So thank you for that. And it was mentioned that there is a thing called Google DeepMind, and there is this within it. There is this thing called AlphaFold. Everybody now can be a structural biologist. Everybody can summon up AlphaFold and look in detail and twizzle around the structures that are based on things like that. But this is a very kind of original static model. So, Tony, it was great that you showed us what lies behind the interface with all of this. And how we got there, and how people like yourself did so much to bring this knowledge forward in these recent decades. I guess also what hasn't been said, it's also worth mentioning that Tony has been a very, very avid and loyal member of Leeds Film Lit, and he's I've said before that I think he's done just about every role in the Leeds Film Lit that it's possible to do, including president. Tony is indeed, in recognition of that, a life member of LPLS. And so it's been a pleasure on many levels to have you here tonight and to have this relaxed combination of discourse, really, about the science and the personal aspects as well.
Thank you.
Now, you may have been looking at this model that's come around, which is a version of this, actually, but in space. The spaces are filled up. And when I look at this, I the first thing I think of actually is not really lysozyme. I think about Henry Moore, actually. So that's another thought for you. I'd just like to finish about science and art, because we like to do everything in LPLS, and we think we're such a unique society that we span all of human endeavour. And there's a lady here who's been looking at an art exhibition in Leeds City Gallery. Who'd like to tell us?
Well, I'll tell you. No, it's not Leeds City Gallery. I had half an hour to fill from a previous engagement to come on here. So I popped into the Stanley and Audrey Gallery. And there's a fascinating exhibition in there of an artist called Mary Griffiths. And Tony was talking about the importance of collaboration within the scientific community, but this artist has collaborated a great deal with biophysicists and certain other scientists and other artists. She produces very precise and abstract works, very meticulously worked. And she's done a lot of work in combination with biophysicists in recognition of pattern making, repetitive patterns and so on. So anybody who is interested in this, pop it in there and you'll find that very interesting, I think.
Thank you very much. Just in case everybody isn't aware, Stanley and Audrey Burton Gallery is in the Parkinson Building, which is the, you know, the main building that you see on the TV of the University of Leeds up the steps. So, and that's open, I think, every day, basically.
Not Mondays.
Okay.
Not the Mondays. The gallery.
Okay. Well, can we just finally give Tony and Kristen a round of applause? Thank you very much.
Well done, superb, and well done, Eric. Eric was so enthusiastic about arranging this evening, knowing that we have amongst us somebody who can tell us what it was like being involved in science some decades ago, and for many decades. And thinking of the link to art, our next event will be on the 27th of February, a lunchtime lecture at the Leeds Art Gallery, and it's Trevor Burgess, who's an artist curator, talking about colour in art. We have an occasional series, and Christine's going to be taking part in that in April, talking about pigments from the point of view of, you know, a different aspect of art. All things to all people, uniquely so, in still going in our third century, which is great. So, and Tony, who's going, I believe you're about to be 90.
Don't mention it.
We can do the arithmetic.
Well, I can tell you, I was born in 1931, so yeah. You've got to be good at arithmetic.
And your birthday comes up next month, I understand. Yeah, so fantastic. A great advertisement for keeping on being engaged and into the advanced third age. Excellent.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Okay, well, I think the arrangements for the rest of the evening, is for those of you who've... who booked dinner, dinner will be served next door. For those of you who haven't, and if you want to hang around here and chat amongst people for a bit, you're very welcome to do that. With that, thank you all again for coming on this this chilly night. Thank you.
Oh, well. Well, that's all right.
It wasn't just all right, it was terrific.
Oh,
thank
really?
You. Yeah, it was better than I ever thought it would be. And thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. Even if I did make a model of the slides, I think they appreciated it.
Great. Excellent.
Thank you. I don't think they noticed.
Thanks, both of you.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Martin. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
I always bring a toy.